This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Well, tonight it's my great pleasure to welcome Whitworth alum and current visiting professor, Dr. Anthony Roden. Dr. Roden earned his PhD in political science from Purdue University. In his graduate work, his research is focused on how revisionist states act and the challenges they pose to the existing international system. Revisionist states like Russia can be characterized as unhappy with their relative power in the international system, and they often seek to change that. Consequences can be wide-ranging and will be the topic of tonight's lecture, entitled Not a New Cold War: Why Russia's Aggression Requires a New Lens. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Roden.
Thank you, Patrick. Let me first of all say thank you so much for coming out on a Thursday evening to come and listen to me talk about Russia. I very much appreciate it. This is so much fun to be back here. As Patrick said, I'm an alum. I was here between 2002 and 2006. And so I've fallen asleep in probably most of the chairs in here, having listened to Great Decision lecturers. So hopefully I can keep your attention a little bit better than visitors I had when I was a student. But also, hang with me. My voice is going a little bit, so hopefully I should be able to plow through this okay. But if I begin to get quieter and quieter, I apologize for that. So tonight, I'm really excited to come here and talk about Russia. I'm excited to talk about this topic because, for me, this example of Russia and what Russia's aggression is doing and what Russia itself is trying to do is a great example of something that got me into political science, especially international relations in the first place. That when I came here to Whitworth, I wasn't kind of sure about what I wanted to do with my life, but it was taking a couple of classes, including classes with Patrick, that really got me interested in international relations and political science. What fascinated me the most was the ability for political science, the ability of international relations to explain what is going on in the contemporary world. That what I was talking about in the classroom transcended beyond the walls of the classroom, but instead had very real-world manifestations, very real-world impacts. If there are any students of mine in here, they can probably tell you how sick they are of doing any current events assignments, because I basically force them to do them week after week. But there's a reason for that, because I believe that we need to understand what's going on in the world around us, and political science can do a great job of talking about and helping us understand this contemporary world and what's going on. So I'm very excited to talk about Russia. This is an issue which I think is very exciting, has a lot of relevance for us today. So my lecture tonight is entitled Not a New Cold War: Why Russia's Aggression Requires a New Lens. Why we need to view this threat, why we need to take a look at what is going on in Russia through a new perspective, through a new point of view. Because after all, whenever Russia, kind of the old enemy, the enemy that for the last 50 years was the Soviet Union, the counterpart, the rival, the geopolitical threat, that we never knew if we were going to wake up the following morning that would be the morning that the balloon goes up, that would be the morning that the Cold War turns hot, that nuclear missiles would go flying back and forth. And so as a result, the legacy of 50 years of living on the precipice of nuclear war and annihilation, that can have a lasting impact on the psyche. And so whenever we see Russia engage in bad behavior, it kind of makes us rightfully nervous. That we kind of go back to the bad old days. We become more and more concerned about Russia, and we're concerned that whatever Russia does, that we're just going to fall back into a new Cold War. That, what Putin is doing nowadays is simply no different than what Stalin was doing, or Khrushchev, or these other Soviet leaders. So tonight, I hope to kind of dispel that myth a little bit. I'm going to play a quick little video clip here that I think does a great job of encapsulating the way in which we view Russia, that whenever Russia does something bad, whenever Russia does something wrong, we tend to kind of automatically fall back to the Soviet Union. So I'm going to play a clip from one of my favorite television shows, The Simpsons. And I think this clip does a great job of highlighting the American mentality, highlighting the way in which we perceive Russia, any sort of Russian aggression. We fall back into this perception of Russia as the Soviet Union. So in this clip, Homer, through a wonderful series of comic misunderstandings, for some reason ends up the captain of a nuclear submarine for the United States. Don't ask me how it happens. But in this, because he doesn't know what he's doing, he's sailing towards Russia. And so here we have the people, the things that the United Nations is thinking about or talking and discussing this wayward American nuclear submarine. So that's how we tend to think whenever Russia does something bad or does something wrong. That's kind of what we think about, that we automatically go back to, our old geopolitical rival, this is the Soviet Union 2.0, this is a new Cold War. And so I hope tonight that with my talk I can kind of dispel us from falling back into kind of that bad habit, that even though Russia does have clear interests, interests which are very counter to that of the United States, especially in a pivotal region in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, that this is not a new Cold War. That as I was telling people about what my goal of my talk is tonight, I kind of came with the line that my goal tonight is to make sure that you leave here just the right amount of terrified. That we aren't too terrified that we're going to fall into a new Cold War, but we still do need to understand that there is some threat here. That there is something we do need to be concerned about. That we don't need to be waking up in cold sweats, threat, you know, envisioning ICBMs going back and forth. But we do need to understand, though, that Russia's aggression isn't just something we can ignore completely also. But Russia does have a clear perspective. They know exactly what they want. So we'll kind of talk about that here tonight. And to kind of lead us into this, there's a great, there's a great survey that was actually just done earlier this week that talked about, or tried to encapsulate how we view Russia. And this is a survey, again, which came out just last week and talked about what is America's greatest enemy? And so Gallup talked to all these different Americans and said, what do you perceive, what country do you perceive is America's greatest enemy? And so we see here that for the first time pretty much in the last 7 or 8 years, Russia is actually the top of the list here at about 18%. More that it is above North Korea, it is above Iran, it is above China. That we are viewing Russia now as our greatest enemy. And there's some ties here. Mitt Romney, for example, back in 2012 when he was running for president, he argued that Russia was our largest geopolitical foe. And so this touches upon some of these concerns that we have about Russia, some of these issues. And again, some of this kind of old-fashioned fear that we have going back to the Cold War. So this isn't just an academic question. That there are a lot of Americans today who are unhappy or uncertain about and very concerned about what is going on within Russia. What does Russia want? How can we view this threat? So tonight I'm going to break my talk down into three distinct areas. First and foremost, I'm going to define what is called the near abroad. I'm going to define this area. I'm going to talk about how Russia views the world, especially the world in its immediate vicinity. It's part of the world, Central Asia, Eastern Europe, the Transcaucasus region, and how they pursue their interests in this region. And then I'll move into why this is not a new Cold War. That even though Russia has these interests, even though they are running counter to that of the United States, this still is not a Cold War 2.0. So having sucked that terror out of you and you can breathe a sigh of relief, I will then scare the dickens out of you about cautions about Russia. You know, issues that we still do need to be concerned about, that we can't just leave here feeling all nice and happy, that there still very much are concerns we need to recognize with Russia. So that's what I'm going to break down my time here remaining with you folks this evening, talking about these three different things, what Russia's interests are, why, given these interests, this is not a new Cold War, but why this still poses a challenge today here in the United States. So before we delve into the near abroad, I want you to just kind of go on a quick little mind journey with me quickly. So just imagine, for the sake of my analogy here, pretend that the United States collapses for whatever reason, because of war, because of economic interest, because we can't decide if a dress is black or blue or white and gold, that we just kind of completely fall apart. And what happens is that the Pacific states, California, Oregon, Washington, Alaska, Hawaii, they form their own independent country of Pacifica. So over, and then everything east of the Rockies, that's still the rump state of the United States of America. Well, over time, let's say that China begins to build military bases in Hawaii, begins to reach out and form trade agreements with Washington State, with California, with Pacifica as a whole, that we see increasing influence of Chinese values and Chinese cultures coming into these areas that used to be a part of the United States. How do you think Washington, D.C. would view that, would view those Chinese actions on these former American colonies, on these former American states? How would they view that? Would that be a threat? Would that be welcomed? What would the U.S. do to protect its interests? Even though Pacifica is an independent country, what would the United States do to protect its interests there? The hypothetical there is very much what how Russia views the world today, especially how it views the near abroad. This is the map of the Soviet Union at the height of its territorial power. And we see here now, this border here is where contemporary Russia is. And so we see all these other independent countries, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia. Please keep an eye on these. I'll be talking a lot about the Baltics because they are of critical importance here a little bit later. Other areas, though, including Ukraine, Crimea down here, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, most things ending in Stan are down here in this region. Now, this is the height of the Soviet Union. Now, again, this, Russia today is very much just this border here, and these are all independent countries. But Russia views this height and views these countries essentially as wayward, as you know, wayward former states. That yes, they're independent, but you know, they're only kind of independent. That Russia still has primacy in this region. That Russian interests and Russian values and Russian foreign policy should predominate in this region, and Russia should be expected to have dominance in this region. So this is what we mean by the near abroad. These three big circles here highlight the areas and what I'm talking about. Again, these are former Soviet states who are now nominal, who are independent entities. Yet to Russia's eyes, these are countries which, again, you know, they were a part of us for a good 50 years, and okay, 10 years ago we broke up, maybe 20 years ago, but that doesn't mean that we stopped talking to each other. That doesn't mean that Russia still doesn't have a say over what goes on in Kazakhstan, or doesn't have a say in what goes on in Georgia or Ukraine or the Baltics region. So this is what we mean by the near abroad. This is a critical region. This is the area that Russia wants to dominate. Envision, if you will, basically Russia's interest. Just imagine a big bubble falling over this entire area here. That is essentially Putin's bubble. That is what Russia wants. So that is Russia's domain. That is Russia's area. They don't want necessarily to expand beyond that, but they want primacy. They want to ensure that their policies, that people who are beholden to Moscow are in charge of the countries inside of this bubble. So that's what we mean by the near abroad. And again, each of these countries are independent countries. They're independent. I'll talk about the word, I'll be using the word states here interchangeably. That's just my international relations nerd showing through. That's how we refer to countries. We refer to them as states. So when I say states, I'm not talking about Washington, Oregon, what have you. I'm talking about actual countries. But you know, these are all independent states. Yet Russia still wants to have a significant amount of control over this area. Wants to still have a significant amount of primacy in this region. For a number of reasons. That first and foremost, it is very much prestige that these former countries marked the high point, the high watermark of the Soviet Union. And so the loss of this territory is very much a loss of prestige and a loss of face for Russia. And Russia wants to recover this. I mean, states are all about pride, just as we are as human beings, which explains why Putin is flying bombers over Alaska and down the English Channel and over Sweden and all these other kinds of places. A lot of that has to do with pride and prestige and showing the flag. So that's one reason why Russia wants to protect itself in the near abroad. A second reason has to do with ethnicity. This is a map that talks about the different percentage makeups of ethnic Russians in each of these regions. Now you notice here that, you know, there's not a majority in even most of these countries except for Russia itself. Latvia at 26, Estonia at 25, even the Ukraine at only 17.3%. Yet within each of these countries, especially here in eastern Ukraine or eastern Latvia or eastern Estonia, northern Kazakhstan, there are areas where the majority of the population is ethnically Russian. And Russia views this as, views its place at the head of the Russian ethnic nation as a place of responsibility. That it is supposed to be in charge of, it is the paterfamilias, it is the fatherland, it is the motherland, it is there to protect Russian ethnics all over the place, even if they are in other countries. But for example, when Putin went into Crimea, he justified it as an act of humanitarian intervention. That he went into Crimea primarily to protect, at least this is how he gussied it up and justified it. He said that he went into Russia, or excuse me, went into Crimea with the sole intention of protecting ethnic Russians in Crimea, which, by the way, is about 65-70% ethnically Russian. So that he was afraid that there was going to be some anti-Russian backlash, so he went in to protect these ethnic Russians in this area. The same way in which the U.S. argued it was doing humanitarian intervention in Syria or in Kosovo in the late 1990s. That is how Putin justified his action. So the Near East for Russia is not just a high watermark or territory. It is linked very much to ethnicity and nationality as well. Russia as the dominant figure and has the responsibility to protect its fellow ethnics, even in these other countries here. So you have prestige and face and territory. You have ethnicity. You also have essentially power. This is a map of the expansion of NATO over time. And what we see is that NATO, especially after the Cold War, has basically gone consistently eastward, closer and closer to Russia's borders. The near abroad provided a great natural buffer for Russia. Prior to 2004, the only country it buffered was Norway, and even here it was just up here. It was a very small amount. And of the NATO countries, Norway wasn't necessarily the biggest threat, nor did Russia have ambitions on Norway. Yet nowadays we see, again, these three states here, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, these Baltic states. Now we have two NATO members who are literally on the border with Russia. We currently have a significant amount of American planes and British planes and French planes currently resting in the Baltic region, flying air patrol missions, diverting Russian bombers away from this airspace. And so this is an area where the near abroad and the West kind of come into contact with each other. This is a fault line. This is very much an overlap and is a place of concern. So for Russia, taking a look, this is very much an invasion of Russia's bubble. That the near abroad is Russia's bubble and you should not be allowed to enter into it. This should be Russia's primacy, Russia's main point. This should be the territory of the of Russia today. But yet here we see it violating it. And so we see concerns here of Russia that we want to stop westward expansion, not just of NATO, but of the European Union, as well as just the values of Europeans as a whole. We'll talk about this a little bit later, but Russia has actually done a great job of creating Russian nationalism, tying in values of Russian Orthodoxy and Eastern Orthodox faith. That when the Ukraine rose up, Putin and his propaganda arm was arguing that this was the rising up of non-religious, secular, European values going up against the traditional Christian values of Russian and the Russian state and Russian Orthodoxy. Very interesting ways in which he's incorporated Russian ideology and Russian nationalism to his main points, to his main goals in foreign policy. So that's how Russia views the near abroad. Again, it's this bubble. It's this area which, yes, these countries broke up, but quite frankly, Russia's like a bad boyfriend. They don't want to let go. They can never find closure. They still want to hold on. They still want to have primacy. They still want to have their point of view, want to have their policies passed in these regions. So how does Russia go about maintaining this policy? How does it go about maintaining its force, ensuring its primacy in these regions? And there's four different ways in which Russia has been able to do this. And it's done this through a wonderful mix, and I don't mean wonderful in the sense that it's great and it fills my heart with glee, but it really is a wonderful mix of soft and hard power. Now, all too often when we international relations scholars tend to talk about power, we tend to talk about tanks and planes and ships and what have you, because they're really cool and they make things explode, which is always fun. But we tend to ignore the soft power aspect of things. We tend to ignore the power of media, the power of the economy, the power of propaganda, the power of people. The more sort of soft power aspects of international diplomacy. And Russia has done a great job of mingling these two together, using the soft power approach and the hard power approach in order to maintain its control in these regions. So I'm just going to talk briefly about how Russia manages to maintain its hold over the near abroad. First and foremost has to do with economy. Russia is fully integrated in the global economy. Russia's economy relies significantly upon the export of natural resources. Two-thirds of Russia's exports are natural resources, primarily natural gas, lumber, as well as oil. So Russia has natural resources to spare. Russia is a modern capitalist economy. It's undergoing a little bit of a hard time right now, but it still has a lot of money and a lot of resources to offer to fellow countries. That this here map is a map of the Eurasian Economic Union, very much Putin's counterweight to the European Union. Now, right now, it only includes Kazakhstan and Belarus, but other countries, Tajikistan, Azerbaijan, Armenia, are looking to join this group. And this is very much a single market, much like the European Union is, trying to ensure the free flow of capital, the free flow of goods, the free flow of people. So by tying other countries into Russia's market, tying other countries into dependence upon Russia's natural resources, Russia is able to gain some leverage and use its soft power to control the near abroad. Putin has also done a great job of propping up dictators, especially friendly dictators. These wonderful group of folks are generally autocrats, authoritarians, dictators, presidents for life, what have you, of the near abroad. Kazakhstan, Belarus, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, all those leaders are represented up here walking hand in hand with Putin. And all these leaders here generally depend upon the largesse of Russia, including the former prime minister of the Ukraine, who signed a deal with Russia instead of the European Union. He had a great big house, he had a private jet, he had all the trappings of luxury generally funded by the Russian taxpayer. So utilizing graft, utilizing bribery, utilizing corruption, Putin is able to ensure that in the near abroad, he has leaders who are first and foremost beholden to Russia, primarily because he keeps them wealthy, keeps them happy, keeps them in power. Putin's also able to do this by dividing up any possible opposition, not just within the near abroad, but internationally as well. That Russia is actually one of the largest international donors to political parties in Western Europe. For example, Marine Le Pen's very extremist, xenophobic, borderline racist party in the far right of France called the National Front, one of their biggest donors is Russia. And then this very recent election in Greece, where the Syriza party, very much a far left, anti-European, anti-bailout, anti-austerity party, again, one of their largest donors was Putin. Now, you're not going to find too many parties which are that ideologically separated. So it's not like Putin and Russia are doing this because they believe the political arguments of these parties. But they're very much doing this because these are disruptive parties, that we've almost had Greece exit the European Union because of the Syriza victory, that on the far right of France, we have very anti-European Union measures. So he spends money and he divides up the political parties of his rivals in Western Europe and other places. Even in the near abroad, if any of these countries pose a threat, any sort of revolution, Russia will find a way to arm certain rebels or to promote certain ethnic tensions or what have you, to ensure that there's always someone in power who is beholden to Russia and beholden to Putin. Another way that Russia does this is through its propaganda arm. And it's this which has become one of Putin's very favorite and very one of its most efficient tools in maintaining his authority over the near abroad, as well as here in the United States. That Russia has spent a lot of money on building up its infrastructure, including its media infrastructure. And the Kremlin is not very friendly to opposition newspapers, or really the opposition overall. In fact, most people, I don't know if anyone here read the story about Boris Nemtsov, a significant opposition figure in Russia who was shot just a few hundred yards from the Kremlin in broad daylight. Very much an anti-Putin critic, leader of the opposition, brutally murdered. So Putin has done a great job of solidifying his power as well as solidifying his media base. The vast majority of Russian media today is very much giving the point of view of the Kremlin, is able to essentially be the mouthpieces of the Kremlin. And it's not just in traditional broadcast media. Social media, Russia is very efficient and very good and has a very large social media presence. There's a whole slew of Russian trolls out there who, if I don't know why you would read the comments, but if you do read the comments on news pieces, you will find a whole bunch of pro-Putin mouthpieces. And part of that is because of this massive supply that Putin has of essentially people sitting behind computers on the payroll of the Kremlin supporting Russia's point of view in cyberspace as well as in broadcast media. And this exists outside of Russia as well. A lot of these Russian television news channels are broadcast into the near abroad. And even here in the United States, this is a screen cap of Russia Today, essentially the Russian version, Kremlin version of CNN. They have a headquarters in New York City. And so there actually is a Russian television station spouting off the entire agenda of Putin and Putin's talking points here in the United States. In fact, I just saw a video earlier today where there's a clip of a Russia Today news speaker and a quote-unquote journalist that they have on talking about this big old conspiracy theory about Russia shooting down Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. How that didn't really happen. How it was actually a Ukrainian fighter plane that shot it down, even though there's no evidence of the contrary. But even still, it's just the Western powers, this big old conspiracy theory trying to frame Russia for shooting down this airliner. Forget the significant amounts of evidence which actually proved that it was Russia, that, or at least a Russian armed, a Russian surface-to-air missile launcher that did shoot down the plane. That there's an abundance of evidence that say that, but yet here, even in the United States, we have Russia Today, we have a news station, which is the mouthpiece of the Kremlin. So it's through this mix of soft power that Putin is able to cajole, to coerce, to buy off, to find some other ways to ensure that the near abroad is always in his orbit, that these satellites are always in orbit around the center of Russia. But sometimes things happen. Sometimes some of these satellites go awry, states act up, and so occasionally you do need to actually find the fist which is inside the veiled glove, that you do need to find and utilize military power. And Putin has not been afraid to do that. Russia fought a decade-long civil war in Chechnya, fought a war against Georgia, the one close to Russia, not the one here in the U.S. You probably would have heard about that a lot more if that actually happened. But the one south of Russia, as well as obviously in Crimea in the Ukraine. The Russia's not afraid to get his hands dirty. Now, it's very much a use of last resort, but it's not completely off the table. Now, in most of these instances, in Georgia, in Transnistria by Moldova, in Chechnya and these other places, Russia has essentially propped up warlords. that has essentially created little puppets and propped them up with a whole lot of money and given them power over the region so long as they remember to kowtow to Moscow. Yet in Crimea, we actually see Russia annexing and taking over territory. This is a huge step, something that Russia has not yet done before. And it highlights a dangerous level of escalation. Maybe Russia now is beginning to look more and more towards utilizing military force. That, you know, annexations we thought were hopefully left in the 20th century. But hopefully that was something we didn't need to deal with today. But yet we have Russia now literally annexing Crimea and then now working on a proxy war in eastern Ukraine, funding rebels, giving them arms, and then even deploying Russian troops, yet without any sort of patches or any distinguishing features upon them. They just speak with a very heavy Russian accent and tend to utilize Russian weapons. So Russia utilizes and is not afraid to use military force, if necessary, to ensure these states stay in its orbit, to ensure that the near abroad maintains and remembers Russia's primacy in this region. So that's how Russia views the world. Again, envision just a big bubble over what used to be the Soviet Union. Any infiltration of that bubble by outside forces, be they American, be they European Union, be they NATO, poses a very real threat. And poses a threat which we need to find some way in order to defeat that or find some way in order to counter that. So having outlined at least how Russia views the world a little bit, I'm going to talk a little bit about how this is not a new Cold War. I'm going to focus on three things. That despite the fact that this is very much a revisionist power who basically views itself as lord over and is still living in the past, as if the Soviet Union had never broken up, that this still is not a new Cold War. Even though the borders may look a little bit the same, that nothing else is. So I'm going to talk briefly about ideology. I'm going to talk about economy. And I'm going to talk about military power. And how in these three ways, and these are just three, there's a lot of other different ways as well, but especially in these three ways, we need to understand that our relationship with Russia and Russia today is significantly different than that of the majority of the 20th century. So first, and probably most importantly, would be ideology. That communism and what we'll just call Putinism, for lack of a better term, are significantly different. That the early communists, especially Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky, they very much viewed their mission that the Soviet Union was almost duly bound to be the vanguard force of a global revolution. It required them, that they were on a mission to literally change the world from one of capitalism and democracy to one of communism and socialism. That the very philosophy they adopted basically required that they don't just sit back behind their borders, but they actually go out on the offensive. And that we fight a global battle of ideas against the bourgeois capitalist democratic forces spearheaded by the United States. And this was truly a global battle of ideas. So even as the rest of the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America and Southeast Asia, as they began to become independent from their former colonial masters after World War II, that the Soviet Union and the U.S. were pretty much always going to be struggling for the heart and soul of that country, regardless how relatively small or insignificant or just geopolitically, how much it doesn't matter, that every scrap of territory was this battle between communism and capitalism, between democracy and socialism. So it was very offensive, and it was global in nature. It's why the U.S. fought wars in Korea and Vietnam, why the Soviet Union fought a war in Afghanistan, why we cared about what the leadership of El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala and sub-Saharan African nations and other tiny countries all over the world, that we actually had a vested interest in ensuring that they were democratic and not Soviet. Because the Soviet Union was very much the counterpoint. It was if you were not happy with democracy, if you're not happy with capitalism, there was an alternative out there. And that was communism. That was socialism. So if you were a newly independent country or just happened to have ousted your leader in a coup, you basically had your choice of sugar daddies. You could go with the United States or you can go with the Soviet Union because it was the alternative. So the Soviet Union was very much offensive in nature, in the fact that it wasn't defensive, but it was on the offense, not that it was offensive, which, well, okay, kind of was offensive as well. But it very much required that countries go on the offensive. It required the Soviet Union be offensive in nature, go out and fight the battles all over the place. It created a military superpower that could patrol the borders all over the globe, back up communist countries all over the globe. So it was global in nature and it was offensive in nature. And it was the main alternative. It was exportable. You could export communism. Putinism, on the other hand, is the completely opposite. You're not going to find too many leaders of newly independent countries or new leaders that will be like, oh, you know what, I'm going to emulate Vladimir Putin. I really like that guy. He's the poster child of everything I want to aspire to. I'm going to implement Russia's style of governance and Russia's style of economy. You're not going to find that. Putinism really isn't exportable. It's not the main alternative to capitalism. So if you're a country today and not happy with democracy, you're not happy with capitalism, you're not going to look to Putin. You're going to look to China, and that's a whole other lecture I can talk about later on. But you're not going to look to Russia. Russia is not the main alternative. So it's not exportable. Second of all, Russian ideology and Putinism especially, it actually is generally defensive. Again, Putin has his bubble. He's not interested about the leadership changes in sub-Saharan Africa, the leadership changes in Latin America or Southeastern Asia. He's just interested about his own little sphere of interest. And yes, inside that sphere of interest, there are places where we, the U.S., have fellow allies of NATO and other interests in those regions as well. Not to say that he just has this exclusive little region to himself, but that's how he views it. So Putinism is inherently regional in nature. And is also defensive in nature. A lot of the ways in which Putin is justifying his actions today is that he is defending against Western aggression. He is defending against Western expansion. He's defending against Western imperialism. That Putin is the savior of the defense. He's not expanding Russia's borders. He's instead reacting to perceived slights, reacting to perceived threats. So this is a huge, huge, huge difference. The fact that we have Putin in power today and not the Soviet Union is a massive difference. This is why one of the main reasons why this is not going to be a new Cold War. Because there are some things that we even agree with Putin, like, for example, free trade, or at least international trade. Putin needs to find markets for his resources. He needs to get money back for his resources. The Soviet Union really didn't engage in a lot of international trade with the capitalist world. It kind of went against their whole philosophy. So we actually have things we agree with Putin. And again, Putin is primarily focused upon his region. He's on the defensive. He's not going to go out and fight tooth and nail for every scrap of dirt all over the globe. He's just going to prioritize the near abroad. The second reason why this is a new Cold War, and I kind of hinted to this already, has to do with the economy. This wonderful little chart here shows the value of the ruble plummeting as the cost of oil goes down significantly. Now, this very much opened up a two-way avenue, a two-way street. After the Cold War finally collapsed and the Soviet Union collapsed, Russia was then incorporated into the global economy. The Russia was now a capitalist society. It had resources. It wanted to make money. In order to do that, you have to trade with other countries. As I said, this created a two-way street. On the one hand, it gave us another avenue that we didn't have available during the Cold War to control Russia's aggression. We couldn't really sanction the Soviet Union or embargo the Soviet Union all that much. We didn't really trade or export or import with each other all that often. We didn't trade that much. So any sort of embargo, what have you, not to say that we didn't, but it didn't really have as big of an impact. That they basically ran the communist international political economy, we ran the capitalist one, and in the end, ours kind of triumphed over theirs. But we didn't have a lot of trading in between. So this avenue for sanction, this avenue for embargo, really didn't exist much during the Cold War. But now we have something short of war that we can really use to kind of turn the screws on Putin. But again, this is a two-way street. Putin has been able to utilize leverage and Russia's massive reserves of natural gas to create leverage over Western Europe. I'll talk about that a little bit later, about why Russia still poses a threat to us today, or why it still bears watching. But just the fact that we agree that capitalism is at least okay, that's leaps and bounds ahead of where we were come the Cold War. Significantly different. So this gave us more tools short of conflict, short of launching our missiles at each other. This gave us another avenue in which we can try to constrain or control Russian behavior. But again, it was very much a two-way street, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. And the third, I want to talk about military power. Now, I love this photo for a couple reasons. First of all, it's because I read entirely too many Tom Clancy novels as a kid, and I love military aviation, and I can tell you all about the F-22 and the Tu-95 Bear and everything else until, well, probably about 10 o'clock, but my voice would probably give out. The second reason why I really enjoy this picture is because it summarizes this huge gap between Russia and the United States today in terms of military power. During the height of the Cold War, our biggest fear was that Russia would swarm the seas with submarines, run over Western Europe with tanks, and blot out the sun with the sheer number of planes that they could send over to the United States. Today, Russia's military has been decimated, especially in the last 20 years or so. This bomber here, this Tu-95 Bear, was built in about the 1960s, 1970s. I mean, it's still driven by propellers, for goodness sake. This is the mainstay of the Russian military, mainstay of Russia's bomber force. And this wonderful little aircraft here is the F-22. Inarguably the most dominant fighter in the sky. Again, I could go off on a tremendous tangent about just why this thing dominates so dang much, but I'm not going to. But just know that this is a state-of-the-art, fifth-generation, stealth, super-cruising F-22 fighter. Dominance of the sky. Now, I know, as you guys have read the papers, you probably have seen a lot of Russian overflights, again, of Sweden. They've sent bombers down the English Channel. They fly close to Alaska. They kind of send bombers all over the place trying to show the flag, in a sense, trying to gain some prestige. Well, they're doing it with these kinds of planes, planes which can be picked up 500s, if not thousands of miles away. That if this war were ever to go hot between the U.S. and Russia, we basically shoot them down before they get even close to us. So even though they are flying bombers close to our borders, this really doesn't pose a threat. And this doesn't highlight that Russia and the U.S. are close to each other militarily. The fact of the matter is that America's military dominance is ridiculous, for lack of a better term. For example, if you were to take the top 10 military spending states and add up everything they spend on their military and basically take out America's portion, America would account for more than 50% of top 10 military expenditure. That, for lack of a better term, is also ridiculous. I'll let you decide if that's good ridiculous or bad ridiculous, but it is still ridiculous. 50% of top 10 military expenditure accounted by the United States itself. So even though during the Cold War, Russia and the U.S. fought conventionally and we were concerned about conventional forces, today, if there ever were a conventional war, it really would not be much of a threat. Now, I'll talk about nuclear weapons here a little bit later. But in terms of conventional power, Russia's military is undermanned, undermoraled, underfunded, and just a little bit further behind us technologically. So they are not the dominant military superpower that they were during the Cold War. So for these three reasons, for economy, for military, but primarily for ideology as well, this is not a new Cold War. We should not fall back into that, that Simpsons clip where, okay, this is it, they've pushed the button, they're Soviet Union 2.0, here we go, Cold War round two. There are significant differences. Yes, it is Russia. Yes, they do speak the same language as they did in those really bad Bond films during the Cold War that they were our main villain. But everything else is completely different. This is not a new Cold War. So now that I've sucked, hopefully, the terror from you, I need to instill a little bit back into you. I need you to understand that there is still a little bit of a threat out there, that we still do need to be concerned about Russia's motivations. We need to be concerned about Russia's goals. Even though Russia does have, essentially this bubble, that still does kind of pose a threat to us. I've got a wonderful little cartoon on my last slide here, which I think best encapsulates this new lens that I'm going to talk about here, about this conflict between regional and global superpower. So I'm going to talk about Russia's economic leverage and its economic tools over our allies. I'm going to talk about Russia's nuclear weapons. Yeah, they still do have about 3,500 of those, so we do need to be kind of concerned about that. I'm going to talk about Russian nationalism and the rise of Russian nationalism. And then finally, I'm going to talk about Russia's ties with China. About how, with these four reasons, this is why Russia is still dangerous, why we still need to be concerned today about what Russia is doing, why Russia still does pose a threat to us here today. So first and foremost, economic leverage. I love this cartoon. I think it best encapsulates Russia's soft power, best encapsulates Russia's economic interests and economic leverage. That a vast majority of the natural gas which heats homes in Western Europe as well as Eastern Europe comes from Russia. And so Russia like OPEC is able to control the flow of oil to the United States and impact our gas prices, Russia just by itself has a significant amount of influence over the cost of natural gas in Eastern and Western Europe. In fact, part of the reason why Ukraine, for example, has to take a $17 billion bailout from the IMF and raise their interest rates significantly is because Russia has essentially shut off the gas or has lowered the amount of gas coming their way and has increased the cost of natural gas. So they have these huge debts. So Russia's economic leverage is something we need to be concerned about. We also need to be concerned because, Russia is getting a little bit desperate. Russia's economy is undergoing a bit of a rough patch. The sanctions have had some impact, especially the sanctions by the United States. They have had some impact, not quite the impact we would like, but they've had some. But the cost of oil plummeting has had a huge impact as well. Russia's bond rating has been rated to junk, which means that they're essentially worthless. They're not going to have any luck getting any international loans from the IMF or anything else anytime soon. So Russia is, they have these tools, they have these weapons. They're also economically a little bit desperate. They're a little bit skittish. They cranked up their interest rates significantly, basically overnight. So there's some threat there that Russia may use that economic leverage to wage economic war against Western Europe and Eastern Europe. It's part of the reason why the European Union and some of our allies have not joined us in sanctioning Russia, or have not imposed as strict sanctions as we have. Now, we here in the U.S., we don't do a lot of bilateral business with Russia. So really sanctioning them and embargoing them doesn't really hurt us too much. But our allies in Western Europe, they very much have a lot at stake. They have a lot to lose if they were to sanction or if they were to anger the Russian bear. So Russia still has significant economic leverage, especially over areas like Western and Eastern Europe, where our allies like Germany and Poland and our other NATO allies almost depend upon Russian natural gas to get them through the winter. So we need to be cognizant of that. Even though it doesn't impact us directly here, our allies are very much under the gun. Second thing we have to deal with are nuclear weapons. There's a wonderful site out there called nukemap.com, which allows you to detonate nuclear weapons over anywhere in the U.S. So you can kind of see whether or not you're going to survive a nuclear strike on Fairchild Air Force Base, for example. It's a lot of fun. It's a good way to kill an evening. In this simulation here, I've detonated a nuclear weapon over downtown Spokane. Hopefully the NSA didn't hear me say that. But in this simulation, you know, so right here we have that nice little one block of downtown Spokane. That's completely vaporized. Here we have everything up to about Francis destroyed by a massive fireball. And then us here, we're actually in that wonderful area where the living envy the dead. We're just going to die of radiation poisoning. And so this is just an example. This is an SS-21 nuclear missile detonating over Spokane, a common missile that is sitting in Russia's military stockpile. A missile of which Russia has hundreds of, and we don't know exactly where all of them are, even still. So Russia has about 3,500 nuclear weapons. And these nuclear weapons give Russia significant latitude, gives them a significant barrier, allows them to get away with a lot more of aggressive behavior. For example, if a non-nuclear armed country annexed Crimea, you could bet that the U.S. was going to be able to respond much more effectively to such an annexation. But because we don't want to violate one of the tenets of that wonderful movie, The Princess Bride, we don't want to get involved in the land war in Asia, especially against a land power with nuclear weapons, we're not going to utilize conventional force. We really don't want to engage in Russia with a conventional war because it very easily could turn into a nuclear war. And this could become a reality. So this is what's at stake. This is like the worst case scenario for any conflict that we have with Russia. We need to recognize that Russia does have nuclear weapons. And that headed by Putin, there are very few little changes of command. It basically is up to Putin's decision himself. There's very little control over Putin. Even in the Soviet Union, they had the Politburo. They had a group of people who were going to kind of ultimately make the decision about launching a nuclear weapon. Today, it's basically Putin's call, yes or no. So we need to be cognizant of the fact that we are still dealing with a nuclear power, a power that has 3,500 nuclear weapons, which could very easily make this fun little simulation a not-so-fun reality. We also need to understand that, again, hand-in-hand with his propaganda arm, Putin is doing an amazing job in creating Russian and fanning Russian nationalism. That any assault against Russian ethnics, any imposition, any view upon which NATO and the European Union is coming close to threatening Russian ethnics, Russian points of view, Russian nationals, even in other countries, that is seen as an attack on Russia itself. And nothing unifies like an attack on a group of people. I mean, just think about us after 9/11. After 9/11, President Bush's approval ratings was in the high 90 percentiles. We were all wearing little American flag pins. We weren't eating French fries for some reason, which now slips my mind. But that we were able to unite in the face of an attack. That helped unite us, that we were all Americans at that point, that we helped overcome these differences. And so that we understood that, you know, we were all in this together. So nationalism can be a very dangerous thing. It can be a great unifying power behind a leader. A recent public opinion survey, for example, in Russia, found that Vladimir Putin has an approval rating of about 88%. 88%. Now, what that really means is there's about 88% of the people in Russia who are scared, too scared out of their wits to say they don't like Putin. When the people call him up and say, hey, you, by the way, we know where you live. What do you think of Vladimir Putin? Is he doing a good job or not? 88% say, oh, yeah, he's doing a great job, and then quickly hang up and try to forget that it never happened. But Putin still does have the backing of the people, or at least the tacit agreement of the people. But Putin is especially held there in power by oligarchs, by people in charge of the Gazproms and the Rosnefts, these huge natural resource companies who fund Putin, and Putin then in turn funds them using state coffers and using taxpayer money to pay off their debts. So he has around him a very strong group of individuals who are beholden to Vladimir Putin, help bail him out economically. But for the rest of the people, they are given a heaping scoop of Russian nationalism, fed through the Kremlin's propaganda arm. And even though most Russians recognize that they are being lied to, most Russians recognize that this is the Kremlin speech, this is pretty much the only outlets that they have, the only news outlets they have available to them. And when, as I mentioned, we see Putin drawing upon and utilizing certain values, even Eastern Orthodoxy and Orthodox Christianity, and tying that into Russian ideas and Russian ethnicity and Russian nationalism. That it's these godless Europeans who are imposing their will on these Russian ethnics in these countries. We need to defend them, defend these strong Russian values from these godless aggressors from the West. That they are violating our little bubble here. So a nationalist, the growth of nationalism is very dangerous. Because generally it wants to have an outlet. I mean, after 9/11, even here in the U.S., our outlet was essentially Afghanistan. We wanted to strike back. We wanted to find some way to deal with this attack. And it was very much fervored and buoyed by American nationalism. Nationalism itself is a very potent force and requires a release valve. So Putin building this up and justifying his regime based upon Russian nationalism is very worrying. Because nothing unifies like a foreign adventure. And nothing really requires a foreign adventure more than a rise in nationalism. There has to be a release of that fervor, a release of that pressure. So the final reason why we need to be concerned about Russia today are Russia's ties with China. This is Vladimir Putin shaking hands with Chinese Premier Xi Jinping after Russia and China signed a $400 billion, again with a B, dollar natural gas deal over the next 20 years. $400 billion. And this is a natural partnership. China is undergoing a massive industrialization, undergoing massive modernization. They have a thirst for natural resources. Russia has them in abundance. Russia needs a market, hopefully not a Western market. So if the sanctions do go through, they still have an outlet for their natural resources. And China is a natural place for that. And so its closer ties with China do pose a threat. Because as I alluded to earlier, it really is Beijing and the Chinese model, which is the primary alternative to capitalism and democracy today. That if you are a newly emergent country, if you are a newly independent country, you're not going to want to emulate Vladimir Putin. You're going to want to emulate China. You're going to want to see the ridiculous, almost double-digit growth in GDP, which China has sustained, the historical modernization, the massive amount of urbanization going on in China. You want to follow that model. That's the model you want to go. So if Russia does tie closer to China, and again, there is a natural fit there, that does pose a threat to the U.S., because Russia very much wants to ensure that its own little bubble is safe. But China, well, we don't really know what China wants. I wrote 300 pages of my dissertation trying to figure it out, and I still don't know. Yeah, don't make me think about those last 2 years I've wasted. We still don't know exactly what China wants, but they may be a revisionist power. That both of these countries may want to make significant changes to the international system. And so if we see the coupling here of Russian natural resources with just Chinese economic growth and Chinese leadership, this could pose a significant threat to the United States. Now, the interesting thing in this, though, is that Vladimir Putin would very much be the junior member of this partnership. And I don't know how Putin would really feel about being the junior member of any partnership. So those are four reasons why we need to be concerned today about Russia. About why, even though this is not a new Cold War, we can't just sort of poo-poo and walk out of here like, okay, everything's hunky-dory. Russia still does pose a threat. But we do need to make sure that we're viewing this through the correct lens, which kind of brings me to my last slide here of the day, which, again, is a cartoon which I think pretty much encapsulates what we're dealing with here. That here we have Uncle Sam drawing his spheres of influence, well, pretty much all over the whole dang globe. We are a global superpower. We are a hegemon. pretty much everything is under our domain. And here we have the Russian bear drawing his little bubble over Russia and the Near East. And then here we have Uncle Sam saying, hey, who do you think you are? And this, I think, is the proper way to envision this conflict. This is the proper way to view Russian aggression, the proper way to take a look at our current relationships. That Russia very much does bear watching. No pun intended. Okay, kind of intended. But that we do need to understand that Russia does pose a little bit of a threat. That even though Russia is local, Russia is regional, Russia is defensive, Russia is focused on its own little bubble, that there still are fault lines, there still are places, there still are ways in which Russia still does pose a threat. I mean, Russia annexed Crimea. I mean, annexation, we thought we left that back in the 20th century. You know, that's what Hitler did. That's what, you know, some of these bad old dictators did prior to World War II and in the Cold War. We thought we left that behind. But no, Russia just went in and took over a good old chunk of territory, violating an international norm that we thought had been established with the end of the Cold War. So Russia is very, very possessive about its bubble. And again, the area which is of significant influence, the area which is significantly worrying, the one group of countries I hope you leave here and kind of keep an eye on for, well, the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, are the Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. These are our NATO allies. Our alliance with them requires that we treat Tallinn and Riga and Vilnius, the capitals of those countries, just as we would treat New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles. That we treat those cities the same. We defend them with the same fervor. We defend them with nuclear weapons if necessary. That is the fault line. That is where NATO alliances and the Near East come into conflict. Because those three states are both. And Russia has engaged in aggressive activity before with Estonia. In fact, one of the first and largest cyber attacks in modern history was actually Russia against Estonia. Because Estonia had the nerve to chopped down a Lenin statue. Estonia was also one of the first governments which worked online and had a significant online interface. And the entire government of Estonia was basically shut down for a few days back in 1998 because of Russian hackers and a Russian denial of service attack. It's another example of soft power. It's not using Russian tanks, planes, or ships, but it's still using ways and finding ways to cajole, to influence, to control the outcome in the near abroad. So that's the new lens. That's the way that we need to understand. That's the way we need to view Russia today. This is not a new Cold War. This is not communism versus capitalism on a global scale. This is instead a very defensive, very touchy. They're still smarting from the loss of the Cold War. They're still smarting from the loss of prestige, the loss of face, the loss of territory. But they are ostensibly still a regional power. And while the U.S., being the global hegemon, is very much a global power. So Russia does pose a threat. Not the new Cold War, but we still do need to recognize that there are places where our interests overlap, places where any sort of conflict could quickly emerge, where we could see some battled patterns begin to emerge like we saw in Ukraine and Crimea. So with that, I'm going to take a quick rest of my voice and drink up. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Thank you, folks.